My name's Marc Gauguier, and I head up the commercial property team at Farrow & Co, focusing on a wide range of commercial real estate investment and development work. On the investment side, we work with a broad spread of landlords, tenants, investors, owners, and occupiers across a range of asset classes, including, of course, offices of all shapes, sizes, types, and locations. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Angie Bennetts of Savills Investment Management, who will be our guest to join the conversation about the future of offices and the role that the office will play in the post-pandemic world. Angie is best known as Portfolio Director for the Charities Property Fund, the first common investment fund available to all charities in the UK that invest in UK commercial real estate. Since its launch in 2000, the fund has grown to include a portfolio of over 100 assets in retail, office, industrial and alternatives, and currently has around 1.2 billion of assets under management. Angie, who has been at Savills Investment Management since moving from GTZ in 2010, is primarily focused on asset acquisition and disposal, and as such is extremely well placed to talk to today's subject. Angie, thanks very much for joining. So if we cast our minds back to this time last year, when the world appeared to be in terminal freefall, there was a lot said and written about the death of the office. As the pandemic has ground on, it seems that people have grown increasingly aware of the realities of the new normal, and as a result, attitudes appear to be changing. So as we emerge from this latest lockdown, do you expect to see people drifting back to the office as restrictions ease? Or do you think that, where possible, working from home will continue to be the not-so-new norm?
Thanks, Marc. I think it's helpful to kind of take a step back, actually, and try to put a bit of a historical perspective on the debate. And the truth is that, you know, we've been congregating in buildings to exchange ideas and engage in business and socialize and develop relationships for, you know, for hundreds of years. Well, millennia, in fact. And I don't see that changing. There is an alchemy, I think, to face-to-face meetings that can't be replicated on Zoom. Having said that, there's no doubt that the pandemic has precipitated significant change. I think one ironic aspect is, you know, over the last two, three or so decades, we've been told at various junctures that everyone's going to be working from home due to the advent of technology, you know, the telephone, the fax machine, email, et cetera, the internet. But actually, none of those technological advances caused a shift to work from home. It took a pandemic to force us to work from home. And prior to the pandemic, if you put a gun to the head of, you know, most typical office-based businesses and said, right, from tomorrow, the 23rd of March 2020, when the UK went into lockdown, your entire business is going to have to work from home, I think most people would have said you're crazy and it can't be done. But actually it was done, and most businesses did react very well to it. Working from home worked. And, you know, indeed, I think there are some indicators that productivity might actually have increased in some cases. However, you know, over a year on, I think it's fair to say that you can feel that the edges are starting to fray. And actually, I think you could feel that sort of 6 months into it or 9 months into it, with fatigue setting in. I think certainly, you know, we've had a bit of Zoom fatigue creeping in. And interestingly, I saw that Citibank have actually banned video calls on Fridays. So if we were having this call and we worked at Citibank, we wouldn't be on the video link. So it's kind of interesting that technology has enabled us to work from home. But another potential irony is that some of those tech companies actually don't seem to be that keen on working from home. So I think Google have said that, sure, you can work from home, but it's limited. You know, there's been a lot of column inches, a lot of hyperbole. Everyone's an expert on this now. And it's almost as if sort of battle lines have been drawn. In one corner, you've got Goldman Sachs. In the other, you've got, you know, a company like Lloyds. Goldman's CEO infamously saying that, you know, working from home was an aberration. And in the same week, you had Lloyd saying, we are going to fully embrace working from home. And by the way, we're going to cut our office estate by 20%. I was on a call, just anecdotally, I was on a call with a Magic Circle law firm a few weeks ago. And the two partners, both of whom were working from home, and we were on a video call, they'd actually superimposed images on their screen backgrounds. One of them was the outside of their London office HQ, and the other one was an image of a boardroom inside that office. So the subliminal message they're trying to communicate to clients is that we're at work, we're in the office, even though actually they were working from home. And I thought that was quite telling. I think we have to acknowledge there's also a sort of generational point here, which actually we're hearing firsthand from occupiers. There is this osmosis factor of listening in when you're in the office to more experienced people around you. And I think that's invaluable. And I think businesses are shooting themselves in the foot if they don't recognize that, frankly. If you live in the commuter belt and you don't have to get on the 6:05 train every morning from Beaconsfield to Marylebone over the last year, you know, you've probably had a pretty good run of it. But if you're 22 and you've just left university and you've just started as a, you know, graduate at an investment bank or at a law firm or at an accountancy firm, and you live in a one-bedroom flat with no outside space, I think you've probably had a tricky time. So the generational point definitely feeds into it, and that links into well-being as well. Certainly that comes into the equation. And I think while some people's work-life balance might actually have improved because of the pandemic, I think there is a growing sense of the blurring between work and life. You know, I've heard the phrase living at work rather than working from home. And again, I think that's quite telling. You know, at times people do feel they're in a bit of a tunnel, actually. But whatever your point, you know, your reference on this and your opinion of working from home versus the office, I think the debate actually is really good for real estate. It's front page news. You can't open the BBC website without some kind of article on the return to office or not. You know, everyone's got an opinion on it, even the Chancellor of the Exchequer, who said, you know, relatively recently that, you know, persistent working from home probably risks losing spontaneity. And I think people miss that point, that actually the debate is good for real estate, and it's up to real estate to react to the challenge, really.
A lot to unpack there. I very much like the alchemy of face-to-face meetings. And I think that's true. It's certainly something I've missed over the last few months. So one thing that commentators do seem to agree on, and as you say, there's been a huge amount of press on this, it is that the pandemic has helped to fast track changes in how we work and live. The living to work phrase that you use is a good one. And that's how I think a lot of us feel. But one way or another, the 9-to-5 office world, or even pretty recent times, you don't have to go back to the bowler hatted days of the 658 from Surbiton, seems to be on the wane. But as part of that, do you think that the shift in focus from city-based office life to more local living could have an unintended consequence of helping revitalize the high street and some of the obsolete retail buildings? And ultimately, do you think we could see a wide repurposing of space?
Yeah, it's a really interesting point to see the sort of the consequences of this, actually. And it depends, is the non-committal answer. You know, I look at my local high street in Zone 3 London, and it's had a good COVID or good run since COVID, actually. You know, more spending has been directed locally. Every other shop now seems to be selling overpriced sourdough, and their queues around the corner. So there could certainly be some pockets of revival where, you know, independent retailers gain some kind of hopefully sustainable foothold, actually, over the long term. I think some of those market towns as well might bounce that were, you know, overshadowed by dominant regional shopping centres, which, you know, clearly are struggling at the moment. And as some of those shopping centres get repurposed, you might see a more revitalising of those sort of local market towns. And it, you know, ESG does certainly play into this as consumers become more socially and environmentally conscious, wanting to support local business. I think betting against, you know, the entrenched trend of online retail is a brave call. Traditional retail, by that I mean bricks and mortar, is going to have a good few months now, which is great news, you know, as consumers emerge from lockdown with a bang, hopefully. And the levels of internet penetration that we saw last year, I don't think will be replicated in 2021. You know, there will be some repurposing for sure, and there'll be some successful repurposing, but I think it's a little far-fetched to think that local high streets are suddenly going to be taken over by small serviced offices pepper potting the high street, with members sort of dipping in and out to take advantage of, you know, free flat whites and Prosecco on tap, and never to stray from their neighborhood again. I don't see that happening. I can see in councils, local councils are going to be, they're going to have to be ambitious and quite radical, I think. You can see a shopping centre in a place like Wimbledon, say, being repurposed successfully, but Stockton-on-Tees perhaps less successfully, albeit actually the council in Stockton-on-Tees have been very ambitious and they do have a vision. You know, I was reading recently that they're going to bulldoze a shopping arcade because something drastic needs to happen because they've lost a huge amount of retailers from that high street. So they're going to bulldoze the shopping arcade and replace it with public amenity and a park, I think, three times the size of Trafalgar Square or something like that, creating a link down into the river. And I can see that actually working really successfully, and they should be commended for that, because that's creating an environment where people actually want to spend some time. I think it's also quite interesting just to sort of consider how somewhere like Oxford Street, the preeminent shopping destination in the entire country, the extent of the challenge that somewhere like that faces, actually. You know, I read yesterday that I think there's 74 vacant shops or shops to let on the street. And if you consider, you know, John Lewis's flagship there, they're converting half of their store to offices. The same's happening with Debenhams and House of Fraser and Marks and Spencer at Marble Arch as well. And the pace of change there has really caught some people out, actually.
So sticking with that theme of the shifting location of focus, there's been a fair amount of talk of late about the 15-minute city, the merits of working closer to home, but still in an office. So if the 15-minute city is the future and the mega city may become a distant memory, what does that mean for prime city centre locations? And are they still going to remain a target for investors? And I suppose I'm thinking not just UK investors, but also the wealthy foreign investors and the wall of capital that keeps on being threatened to come into the UK from overseas.
Yeah, so I'm personally not convinced about the 15-minute city. I think we have to remember that London is one of only a few truly global cities out there, and its gravitational pull is enormous, and I think that will prevail. Yes, mega cities have had a terrible time, but write them off at your peril, I would say. New York, the office vacancy rate there is very, very high at the moment. London too. But I think London's appeal to investors will endure. And also, actually, the success of the vaccination programme in the UK will probably give the UK a bit of competitive advantage and a bit of a head start, actually. But I think the London office market will have another weak year in terms of occupier activity, for sure. And the fundamental reason for that is that a lot of these occupiers are still trying to work out how the pandemic actually affects their business in terms of property. And the truth is that the majority of tenants out there are still trying to work that out, still trying to work out how much space they need. So they'll likely remain in a holding pattern for the rest of the year. And that means that I think occupier activity will be depressed. There's very little price discovery on rents at the moment because of that absence of occupier activity. And in that climate, I think rents are going to continue to be under pressure. There is going to be a pickup in activity, you know, as confidence hopefully returns in the summer. It certainly looks like that's happening, but that is from an exceptionally low level of activity. I think it just comes down, as always, it's nuanced, isn't it? It comes down to the quality of the asset and the location. If you've got a good quality asset and a good location, you'll survive. If your asset is over-rented, in need of capex, in a secondary location, not near transport, you're going to struggle. But that's nothing new there. And we're seeing that firsthand. Actually, one of our mandates, our pension fund mandates, has just agreed to put a London office building under offer to a single occupier at a rent in excess of what they're expecting pre-COVID, actually. And that's very telling. It's a quality asset in a really strong location. So its appeal endures. But on the other side of the coin, there will be buildings in London that office tenants who have leases at the moment will never return to, probably. Outside of London, sort of moving away from the thrust of the question in the megacity, I think, you know, there will be certain locations like the Oxfords and the Cambridges and the Baths and the Brightons that actually probably do quite well. Fundamentally nice places to live with established corporate occupiers as well. And people have realized that, you know, they don't have to be tethered to their desk in the square mile for 5 days a week now. So there is going to be some filtration outside of London. I think one interesting sort of indicator, just to round off on your sort of overseas money point of the question, was that actually at the end of last year, there was a return of some of the German open-ended funds to the London office market. I think overseas investors have always been drawn to the transparency of the London market, but also the yield arbitrage. So, you know, London at 4%, say, is really quite attractive through the lens of Berlin offices at 2.5%. So, yes, I think there will be some return of overseas capital for sure.
On that positive note, to shift slightly away, our experiences, and this echoes slightly what you were saying earlier, our experiences in the market over the last couple of years suggest that where there is demand, increasingly it will be for high quality grade A stock. To a great extent, this follows what was an existing trend pre-pandemic for investors and other stakeholders to improve on their ESG performance. So with that in mind, and given also that I'm aware of your knowledge of all things ESG, do you think that the pandemic has brought into sharper focus and accelerated the need for buildings to be both more sustainable and to support physical and mental well-being? And as a related question, where will this leave grade B assets?
Quick answer is yes. I mean, my own view on this is that actually the opportunity lies in upgrading existing stock, some of that grade B perhaps that you were talking about. You know, why tear it all down and start again? Actually, that's very counterproductive to the environment. I think there's a danger that the market is obsessed with, from an ESG perspective, the operational carbon footprint of a building in the future. And yes, that's hugely important, and we've got to focus on that. But actually, if you look at it, the majority of a building's carbon consumption is done at the development stage. So there has to be an opportunity to conserve the embedded carbon within a building rather than destroying it and consuming more through development. That's one of the reasons why we've been buying, you know, industrial assets for decades, and because they don't have the obsolescence, clearly. But we're here to talk about offices. And actually, you know, for some of our capital, we like heritage buildings within the office sector. You know, they're attractive buildings. They resonate with occupiers. They've been something different in the past. For example, a Victorian warehouse. They're an office today, but they'll be something different in the future. So you've got an investment that is underpinned by alternative use, but also it's a sustainable investment. And that makes a lot of sense to us. And just going back to the basics, they've got great natural light. They've got very high ceilings. They've got simple things like windows you can open. You know, the steel and glass towers, which consume a huge amount of carbon to build and have complicated and costly plant and machinery in them, not to mention, you know, whizzing people up to the 35th floor in a lift. They do look a little bit out of place today, you know, particularly when you can only fit one person in a lift at a time because of COVID restrictions. The trend towards ESG was, you know, unquestionably happening before the pandemic. And if you look at the best developers out there in the office sector, say Derwent, for example, you know, they put a running track on the White Collar Factory at Old Street Roundabout, you know, years ago. Google, for their ground scraper in King's Cross, they're going to put a basketball court in it. They're going to put a swimming pool in it. They're going to put a running track on it. You know, the writing's on the wall here. And if you don't embrace it, then you're going to be left behind.
You're going to have a gym going in at Margaret Street.
Well, I was going to say it's probably a bit far-fetched to think of a running track on the top of 66 Lincoln's Inn Field, but never say never.
Never say never. The world is changing. And that's quite a nice segue on actually to the next thing that I wanted to raise, which is that the pandemic has obviously come at a time, an interesting moment in the future of offices and where they were going anyway. I mean, there'd been mutterings about change, I think, as you alluded to earlier. And we've already seen a good deal of change and an increasing number of disruptors in the sector, some of whom have been notably more successful than others. And I know that there are various businesses who are looking to take this forward. In the context of offices and the way that the impact this has had on employers through lockdowns and the pandemic generally, what's the most innovative response or responses that you've seen to it, both, I suppose, yours itself and also through the Savills Investment Management?
So Twitter were out of the blocks pretty early on this, weren't they? And they said their employees could work from home forever. So that's pretty innovative. Or actually, is it Goldman Sachs saying working from home is an aberration? And is that the innovative thing today? I'm being deliberately provocative, and they're going against the grain probably, but it'll be interesting to see how that works out. And, you know, clearly there's a balance. I think it was Unilever's CEO who hit the nail on the head, actually, when they remarked that persistent working from home did risk sort of eroding the social capital that there is within a business. You know, unquestionably, things have changed. There is going to be more of this working from home, but it's a balance, as I said. How far that balance is tipped depends on all sorts of things. It's, you know, it's personal as well as corporate circumstances. I never worked from home before the pandemic, but I certainly am going to in the future, whether that's 1, 2, 3 days a week, or sometimes 5 days a week, or sometimes being in the office 5 days a week. The point is, I think that's better for the employee, but I also think it's better for the employer. I can do certain things more efficiently at home, but equally, there's no doubt in my mind that team productivity is enhanced by being together in the office for certainly some of the time. And I suspect it'll end up being the majority of the time, actually. In terms of innovation, I think in my experience, actually, a lot of companies, to their credit, have been innovative. What we have to recognize is that several years of innovation were compressed within a couple of weeks or a couple of months last year of intense innovation at the beginning of the pandemic. So I think credit to the majority of the companies out there, actually, who have embraced this, actually, and have been able to work effectively throughout it. My own view is that, you know, I don't see working from home versus the office as an either-or choice. I think, actually, they're complementary.
Yeah, I think, interestingly, as I've posed the question in other conversations, that does tend to be the answer that's coming through. And I think that's right. In a way, it's a sort of quiet revolution that if I think about, you know, the businesses that have managed to survive and thrive, and actually a number of professional services businesses have had exceptionally good years. Now, is that actually sustainable, though? Because, you know, how is that going to pan out when we're allowed to go back out and end up down the pub at 5:30 and maybe not feeling quite so clever first thing on a Friday morning versus, you know, switching off at 11:30 and starting again at 6 a.m. I think you're right. I think there is a really interesting balance that's very instructive to see how that pans out. But again, one can't lose sight of the fact that you do need, harping back to what you said earlier, that alchemy produced from face-to-face, not just meetings, but workforces and getting everybody in a room together to be able to read each other's body language properly and not just through slightly stilted online chats. So to bring things together, given your role and your perspective that you can have on the market and how you see it going, there are two final, slightly separate points, although related, I guess, that it'd be fascinating to get your perspective on, which apply equally to offices and other asset classes. So the first is, and you touched on it a little bit earlier, but what are your predictions for rental yields and capital values in the months to come? And will they vary wildly across investment classes? And secondly, do you expect rent collections to increase as restrictions are relaxed? Or do you think the government simply kicked the can down the road through the measures it's put in place throughout the pandemic to protect occupiers?
So I'm firmly in the Warren Buffett camp of thinking that forecasting actually is a fool's game. And I think, you know, as one of the ultimate black swan events, if COVID has taught us anything, it should be the folly of making forecasts. Clearly, I'm trying to dodge the question. You know, in January last year, for example, most property commentators would have been forecasting office rental growth for 2020. But clearly that didn't happen. Rent collection, you know, the rate and velocity of rent collection is going to increase as restrictions lift. I think landlords have to be sympathetic and realistic in some circumstances as cash flow for those businesses has been decimated in the last 14 months or so through no fault of their own. Equally, there are some businesses out there who did remain open, are solvent, have robust balance sheets, and actually traded quite well throughout. And they haven't paid a bean in rent since the emergence of COVID, because the government effectively made rent payment voluntary. Time to pay up would be my feeling of that group. In terms of the wider capital markets, it's quite a confusing picture. There are certainly signs of euphoria out there, which will make some people nervous. If you look at the special acquisition or SPACs that are emerging over in the States, which are just listed cash shells. If you look at Bitcoin, if you look at GameStop, if you look at S&P 500, an all-time high, that could cause some concern for some people, or certainly an indication of euphoria, as I said. Call me old-fashioned, but I think in an environment where interest rates are pinned to the floor and are likely to remain so, I think real estate yielding 4% or so looks supported. We are certainly seeing a lot of investor demand, but it's channeled. So if you own logistics, life sciences, data centers, food retail, then you're on the right side of the bet during COVID. I think offices do remain tentative. Shopping centers and fashion retail are in dire straits. But I think there is perhaps an emerging feeling that logistics perhaps is becoming overbought. And there are some signs of recovery in some elements of retail, such as retail warehousing. So across the property sectors, it'll vary significantly, I would say, over the next few months. But in general, I think the investment class remains supported.
As a manager of a balanced portfolio, do you think that office weightings are likely to change dramatically over the next 5 years or so? Or do you think it's more, again, an evolution into seeing how the market responds?
I don't think dramatically. In our portfolio, offices is about 20% of our exposure. We don't own in the Square Mile. We don't own in Canary Wharf. We don't own in traditional Mayfair for within the charity's property fund. We've always favoured those locations such as Clerkenwell, Farringdon, Shoreditch, those kinds of locations where actually we've seen quite a lot of rental growth over the last decade or so. But still, the rents look relatively affordable compared to, say, the Square Mile and traditional Mayfair. I think weightings in offices, there will be some people who are perhaps panicking at the moment and might press the sell button. But I don't think there will be a huge, in 5 years' time, as your question asked, is there going to be a dramatic reduction in weightings? I wouldn't believe so, actually, would be my take on it.
Angie, thanks very, very much. Great insight, very interesting, very balanced. And I'm sure anyone listening to this will take a lot away from it. So thank you.
Thank you, Mark.